So this business of standing up for your rights is in the process of going viral.
Yeah, I think it really is. It's everywhere from the Middle East to Wisconsin to Maine to Colorado.
Yeah. It's amazing, this time that we are in.
Greetings. This is William Evans. We're shifting gears. Our guest today is Deborah Evans. She's not a relative, but she comes from Sedgwick, Maine, a town of 1,100 people. Deborah and her husband live on a 25-acre organic farm near the coast. They raise heritage pigs, goats, and sheep, harvest fiber and meat from animals, and make soap. Welcome, Deborah.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
100 years ago, the Maine food supply was locally self-sufficient and sustainable. What are the percentages today? What's the food situation like for you?
Well, in Maine, we know that 93% of the food that goes through our grocery stores comes from out of state, and I'm sure a lot of it comes from out of the country, and some of it comes from very, very far away.
But local exchanges and purchases are important to you and your neighbors.
Yes, because we've been farming here, well, for several hundred years. The land that I live on was part of a plantation that was set forth by George III in 1763. That was so that people could come here and begin to occupy this part of the Europeans could come and occupy this part of the world. And in so doing, they, of course, had to raise all of their own food. So this land has been farmed since the 1760s.
Wow.
As so much of the land around here has been. But then with the onslaught of the industrial agriculture model, that farming, the idea of getting big or getting out in this kind of a environment where it's very rocky and somewhat hilly and very coastal, we don't have large farms. They are all typically 100 acres is huge where we are.
So you felt a need recently to pass a local food and community self-governance ordinance. What inspired that action, and tell us about it?
To try and make it kind of brief, because it is sort of a long story, another farm that I'm very close to, a neighboring farm in Penobscot, they were raising chickens on their farm, probably 300. It was part of the whole farm picture, and they were butchering them on farm. And they had a dairy cow, and they had some goats and sheep, and raising vegetables, and they both were working off-farm. And then they decided that they really wanted to farm full-time, so they needed to increase things a bit, and they decided to set up a farm store attached to their house, and they asked the Department of Agriculture to come and give them a license so that they could have a small retail store on their farm. And in so doing, along the way, the regulators said, oh, and by the way, butchering those birds on your farm is no longer legal. You cannot sell those birds for retail. And we're talking about 300 birds. So they said they took their birds down the road to another farmer who had a nest egg that he could invest in an ample facility to butcher his birds, and that cost him $40,000 10 years ago. And that facility met all the requirements of a larger production model, up to 20,000 birds a year. So Heather and Phil took their birds down there. Bob was only butchering on Thursday, and Heather and Phil would bring their birds on Tuesday. And that was fine. And then the state said, oh, no, you can't do that. Bob's license only allows him to butcher his own birds. If he's going to butcher other people's birds, then he cannot butcher his own birds. None of this makes any sense, but that's the way the law was. So we went to the State Department of Agriculture's committee hearings in the legislature, and we were told that those are the regulations. The Department of Agriculture was there saying, yeah, we can't modify these regulations because that's what the FDA and the USDA tell us we have to do. And we said, well, why? We're just small farmers trying to sell healthy, nutritionally dense food to our friends and neighbors, people that live around us. This is just in our town. It's not going out of state. It doesn't even get close to the state line. They said it doesn't matter if we don't do what the FDA and the USDA say we have to do for these regulations, they will pull all of the USDA support for the USDA inspection program in Maine. And that meant that USDA inspectors would be pulled out of 5 slaughterhouses. Not that Maine exports much meat, but there is a need for some USDA inspection under the current rules. This was a year ago, December, and this was a previous administration, a previous House of Representatives, and a previous Senate. Things have changed dramatically here, politically, since a year and a half ago. And we felt that that was a dead end to go to our legislators. They said they could hear us, but they certainly couldn't reach us to help us. So we said, we got together over a kitchen table potluck and said, what are we going to do? That meant that the farmers who were involved in this kitchen processing and also several of us who were not only concerned for our own farms, but also patrons of our farms. And we got together and said, we have to do something. And the local ordinance model is being used or has been used in other towns in Maine, about 10 of them, I think, maybe more, under our home rule statutes.
Right.
And I believe there are 43 states in the United States that have some form of home rule provision in their state constitution.
And we're a home rule town.
Yay.
Yeah.
Because we think that that's an important aspect to our ability to do what we want to do here. So we started looking at what other towns had done, and they are called citizen-initiated rights-based ordinances. And as far as we know, none of them have been challenged by the state to date, and they cover such things as one town passed a no GMO ordinance. Other towns in Maine, you know, we're known for our water, and Poland Springs started here. Poland Springs now is owned by Nestle out of Switzerland, and they were not only tapping the water in the original town of Poland Springs, but they were going to other towns and tapping into the aquifers and draining the aquifers. And the towns used their citizen-initiated rights-based ordinance to say no, and Nestle closed down their test wells and left. So we'd like to think that maybe it's working. Don't know for sure.
So tell us about the ordinance that you wrote.
So the ordinance that we started, the ordinance itself is based on those rights-based ordinances in Maine and work that was going on in Wyoming and in Florida at the statewide level. So we used those as models, and then we also contacted Farmer-to-Consumer Legal Defense Fund, and who is working with farmers on other farm issues, especially raw milk, and the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. You can find that both of those groups on their website.
Yeah, I looked at them. They're wonderful.
And the Alliance for Democracy also has some information. So all of that information over time came to our little group. And by last November, we felt like we were able to step away from the kitchen table and take the ordinances to 4 towns. The reason we went to 4 towns is because we felt that if we did this in just one town, we wouldn't be able to attract enough publicity. So we started the process in 4 towns because those of us at the table represented 4 towns. And we have now, we went to our selectmen, which is our form of government here, presented the ordinance to them, talked about it, and asked that it be put on the warrants for the annual town meetings, which is also part of our form of government. And it has been placed and voted on in 3 towns, and the 4th town will be voting on the 2nd of April.
All right.
2 of the towns that voted, they voted in an open town meeting where there was discussion at the meeting, and those 2 towns voted unanimously in favor for it. The 3rd town had a different format of voting on it, and we think that because the issue needs to be understood in order to vote for it, we think that a lot of the people in the secret ballot on a separate day might not have been as aware of what the issue meant. So we're going to go back and do it over again in Brooksville because we'll have more time to kind of bring everybody along education-wise. But Blue Hill on the 2nd will be voting in an open town meeting.
And what's been the result so far of your making this ordinance?
It has changed a couple of things. Heather and Phil and Penobscot hung the milk sign out on their signboard at the road. Bob St. Peter and his daughter started a little cookie company called Papa Luna's Cookies, and it's by subscription only. But they wouldn't have been able to do that without this, the local ordinance. We haven't been visited by anyone telling us we can't do this, so the assumption is that they're legal. I've been making my criminal caramels now and selling them. And I think that's all a part of this, too, because I only sell them locally and to friends, and I give a lot of them away. But they're made with the caramels are made with the lard that I render from the pigs that we raise. And I think it's changed a lot of people's attitudes about how important, they've stopped to think about how important the food they get from their neighbors really is important.
Yes.
And if the only thing they had to choose was what was available in the grocery store, they wouldn't be as happy as they are now. They like their food supply, and they would like to see it bigger and better and healthier. And we think that if nothing else happens, it's given people the opportunity to think about what's important and to make their voices heard.
And you're also working at the state level in Augusta.
Yes, we are. The representative for the area, part of the area that our four towns cover, when he was running for office last summer, and of course he was elected in November, he knew several of the people involved in this, and he knew what issues they had been having with the state. And as he went around campaigning, he asked all the people that he was talking to what they thought about the importance of food freedom and the ability to go to a church supper and eat Aunt Mabel's pie and Lydia's baked beans and that kind of thing. And to a person, he said that they all said yes. We want to keep that in our communities. I want to be able to go next door and buy three chickens from Jim. While he was campaigning, started to develop this bill, and it was printed, and we had a public hearing on it on Tuesday, and we also had a public hearing on four other items that were agriculturally related, and it was a long day in Augusta. There'll be a working session next week, and we'll see where it goes.
So have there actually been church suppers and food clubs that have been raided and shut down?
Not in Maine yet, but we have a lot of information from different clippings and articles that we found online. And actually, there's a woman who, Washington State, the Estrella Creamery, she was shut down by the FDA. She'd been working for 8 years with her Washington State licensing department, and she'd been following all the rules, clean tests, everything was wonderful. The FDA went on a sweep through, I believe, about 108 small artisan cheesemakers across the country during the summer and fall a year ago, with the attempt to collect enough information so that they could support their premise that by 2020 there should be no raw milk, dairy, or dairy products in this country. That's their goal. And so they went through all these dairies. And in the Estrella Family Creamery, they found samples, a sample of listeria on, I believe, one cheese in one cheese room. But unlike with corporate America, where they just do a recall, they wanted her to throw away all of the cheese in their cheese room that was aging, i.e. their inventory, i.e. their family income. And they gave them an 87-page draft of new rules and regs. And then they wanted them to reimburse the FDA for every trip that they made to their farm at something like $75 an hour.
You're sensitive to threatening action from federal regulations, even when they're carried out by the state inspectors.
In this particular case, she answered that question for us because the Maine Cheese Guild, which is a bunch of licensed and inspected dairies, felt that because they were working with the state regulations that they would not be have to answer to the FDA because everything was clean here under the system that we have. And her response is basically, oh, no, just because you've got a good track record in your state, the FDA will do whatever it wants to do. And in her case, they came through under the Commerce Clause because her rennet and I believe the soap that she used for cleansing came from out of state. What the government uses is the Commerce Clause to get their way within the state.
Who's making these new federal rules?
Well, our Congress actually helped enhance these federal rules. I guess a lot of the rules have been around for a while, but the enforcement has been ratcheted up, we believe, although to a small degree supposition and a lot of hearsay, we believe it's because of the export business. Industrial ag exports beef, poultry, chicken, cheese all over the world. And they are afraid that if they don't have complete control over all the foods grown, then if anyone got sick from, let's say, a small dairy in Wisconsin that just serves or has milk for its community, then that would paint the entire industry with a bad brush, and then their exportability would go down. So that's part of the justification for their coming out and taking control of everything, because they need to control also the rumor mill. And we're saying, no, you don't need to control how we behave in our communities, because we believe that food safety, in spite of the Food Safety Modernization Act, food safety begins with the private relationship between the farmer or kitchen preparer or gardener or fisherman and the patron that he or she sells their food to.
You know, Deborah, I looked up the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and in Wikipedia they give a history about the formation of the Department of Agriculture, and it first started as an independent department under Lincoln in May of 1862, and Lincoln called it the People's Department.
Oh, my, my. My, oh, my.
Who do you think is really behind these regulations?
Well, it's not the people. It's a corporate agenda. If you look at the amount of money that is spent by the top five or six companies that raise the meats, raise the grains, process the meats, process the grains in this country, it's a very closely held interlocking web of corporate cross-directorships.
I understand, though, that the USDA allows meat to be imported from 38 different countries.
Yes, they do. And there are no USDA inspectors in those slaughterhouses either. I read that on one of the industry blogs that they were considering lowering the standards on the importation of poultry from China in an effort to export more beef to China. So our rules are not about food safety. Our rules are about exports.
Well, I'm certainly concerned about food safety. We all are. But local responsibility is a pretty powerful influence on my behavior.
Yes. I mean, if I made a bad sausages, I mean, if I made sausages, right now I do not, but I'd like to. If I made a bad batch of sausage and someone got sick from that, I'd never be able to sell another pound of sausage in any of the towns around here.
So your reputation requires you have a real incentive to be meticulous.
Exactly. Because, I mean, it's the same food that we feed to our families is the food that we're selling to our neighbors and to our patrons. And the people that come to our farms, the people that come to our farm stands and our farmers markets, those are inconvenient and they're more expensive, and the stuff that they want is not always available. And yet they still come. And they come because of they have the direct relationship with the source of their food. People want to know where their food comes from. And the USDA and the FDA do not let us know, A, what's in all of our food, or B, where it comes from. For instance, GMOs. There's a huge rallying across the country tomorrow about people demanding to say, we want to know what's in our food and we want genetically modified food labeled. I mean, all they want is just a label. We're not banning it. We just want it labeled. And so, you know, all these things are kept secret from us and we're told that it's all safe, but there seems to be a mounting body of evidence from various studies done around the world that there's a big question over the safety and long-term viability of these genetically modified organisms. There's a lot of reason to question what's behind the plastic wrap in the grocery store.
Yes.
I use the phrase that number of people who handle the food is inversely proportionate to the quality or food safety factor of the food that you eat. Does that make sense?
Yes.
When you buy local.
So you grew up on a farm, Deborah. Tell us about your family farm and how that evolved.
I grew up on farms in Ohio, and part of my childhood farming experience was in a Mennonite, densely populated by Mennonite communities in eastern Ohio. And it was very old-fashioned by today's terminology. Everyone helped. There were barn raisings and on-farm slaughter of beef and pork, and we had chickens. My grandmother raised 300 poults every spring. The back room in the house that my father grew up in was where it was a cold room. We didn't heat it, but that was where all the bacons and hams were cured by my grandfather, and on boards that he only used. He washed them down every year, and they were only used for curing ham and bacon. And he was known, he would go to different farms to do the kill shot because his accuracy was so good. And he would always put down an ear of corn so that the pig was occupied and still. And that way there was no suffering, no problems. It was with a great deal of respect on slaughter day. It's not easy for anyone or for the animals, but that's why we raise them, is for meat, and it's done very carefully. So with that in my childhood, both of my parents grew up as farmers and from generations of farmers, and they had plans to farm too, but they found that with Earl Butts shouting, get big or get out, that they too, even with off-farm jobs, could not support having a farm. So we moved to the city, and my dad did another business, and my mother was a nurse, and that was that. And the last place I wanted to be was a farm. But that's all changed. That was in the 50s and 60s, and here I am farming.
All right. Tom Lindsay of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund told me over 120 communities across the country have created protective community or food bill of rights.
Yes.
And that some towns have even blocked gas drilling and hydrofracking. I saw that Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has said no to gas drilling.
Yes, it's amazing what their acronym is CELDEF. It's amazing the work that CELDEF has done over the last 16 years. And it's all based on community, citizen-initiated, rights-based work. And one of their major elements that we were not fortunate enough in our time frame to be able to educate our communities to get their brains around is the rights of nature.
Yes.
And we hope, those of us who've been working on this ordinance, we hope that now that we have everybody's attention and we've started to talk about things outside of what we, outside of clear and present dangers, that maybe the next step for us will be to be able to have a democracy school here at some point during the summer and explore the concept for our communities of ordinances that are entertain the concept of rights of nature. We have an issue here with blueberry spraying. We grow a lot of blueberries, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture requires that certain pesticides that are known to be deadly to bees and other insects, the USDA requires that those be sprayed on the blueberries so, for export. because if they find certain levels of bugs, then they will have to throw that product away. And that spray, because it's done by aerial spraying, is causes drift onto adjacent properties and into the watershed and into our streams and rivers and eventually the ocean.
This has been wonderful. I understand from you that local food is food security and that we may have to get active to protect that resource.
We say the food, the meat, dairy, vegetables, fruits that are grown by our friends and neighbors, that is food security. That is food safety.
Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun, and I enjoyed speaking with you.
It's been great to talk with you. This is William Evans. You're listening to Shifting Gears. I've been speaking with Deborah Evans in Sedgwick, Maine. This is KDNK. Thank you for listening.